Chapter 20, February 2057. The smart plane, a State Department loan, small, fast and nimble, ducked down out of the low clouds that blanketed much of the coastal plain around Anchorage. Alaska from the air looked odd, Mel thought. This was the state capital, a city of white blocks of relatively new developments, scattered like a giant's toys around an older, dingier core. Clearwood windows returned sparkling reflections, a sign of the climate migration population boom this most northern of the old Union states had enjoyed, or suffered, in the last few global warming decades. But in the wider landscape beyond, as the plane came down through turbulent air, Mel saw open ground that itself looked unusual, dimpled, pitted, scarred, the low sunlight casting distinctive circular shadows, as if from lunar craters. Meanwhile, though this was still winter, there wasn't a trace of ice or snow to be seen around the city. Indeed, nothing truly wintry until she ducked her head and peered to the north, where at last she caught glimpses of ice. She shouldn't be surprised, really. Despite its reputation, southern Alaska hadn't been a snowy wilderness for much of her own lifespan, probably. Maybe post-blink, that was going to change. And in the meantime, she knew much of the US administration was holed up here, including the president's science advisor, who they were here to brief. Even if, she knew, Lee Yamanaka had no real idea of what kind of news they were bringing. She turned from the window to look back at Shi, stiff in his exoskeletal support, her only companion on this flight. Or rather, she was his companion, on a trip that had been set up through contacts via Marlowe and Fred Bowles. On the surface, this was Shi's mission, to share his insight into the blink's timing, to leverage it to help Serena Jones persuade the US government to respond to the blink event in some quixotic fashion, it seemed, a project whose details Mel herself was yet to learn. But this was a fairly sensitive diplomatic moment too, Mel had come to realise. They had news the US government needed to learn, and which it might not like learning. So leak it through a low-level contact like this, and let it filter up before the formal stuff. And to hell with the weight of responsibility poor low-level Mel might be feeling. Right now, she was buried in his reading materials, phone images and sketchy graphs and charts, including what looked to Mel like engineering cutaways. A clue to what he had to present, maybe. She himself had changed so much since the blink. As much as anybody she knew, she thought, or more. Once, before that day, he would have been bagging a window seat, peering out at this climate change landscape, speculating, hypothesizing, a still young, curious, supremely bright astronaut scientist. Everything was different now. Everybody was different, but she, particularly, was transformed, lost in his own reclusive obsessions. But then he had a right to be. He had lost somebody close through the blink. He wasn't alone in that, especially if you included those left bereaved by the ongoing aftermath of the event. Still, it made it personal, and for she, the loss had been horribly public. At the same time, though, Tash and Mel, gossiping, had speculated that maybe she, who had always seemed the least academic of them, was emerging as some kind of tormented, mixed-up genius. After all, it had been a key insight of his. The timing of the lurker signals that had unlocked that bit more of the enigma that was Galaxius. Even if he was still reticent about the details, even to his closest friends, to Mel and Tash. He was the one invited to the Winter White House. He was the one Serena Jones had co-opted as a public face of her still-secret space project. Maybe they had been too close to see him clearly over all these years. And maybe there was still some kind of competition going on with his remote, aloof space scientist mother. You're here to support him, Mel, not psychoanalyze. The plane made its final run-in. From above, a new airport was a compact, criss-cross mesh of short runways and scattered buildings, blocks of reflective white and silver. The plane ducked down into this complex, along a startlingly steep descent curve, touched down with scarcely a jolt, and rolled quickly to a halt. She folded up his phones with a snap, glanced out of the window, and got up without a word or a glance back at Mel. A car drew up at the bottom of the debarkation escalator, sleek, smart, its hull white, marked with the roundel logo of some US federal government department. As they deplaned, the car's gullwing doors opened. Out climbed a bulky figure, a woman, swathed in a thick black coat. Under an impressive fur hat, her face was broad, dark. She waved at them. Mel recognized her immediately, and she suspected she did too, given his slight hesitation. Mel walked up, hand extended. "Professor Yamanaka, we virtual met on Blink Day, in the English government briefing. I was supporting Charlie Marlowe." Yamanaka grinned as she enclosed Mel's hand in her own gloved paw. "Melissa Kapoor, right? Charlie always speaks highly of you. And Wu Shi?" Another handshake. "Now you I would have recognised anyhow. After the Al-Mariq tragedy, your personal connection to that, I'd say you have the privilege of owning one of the most famous faces on the planet. But I guess you would give it up in a flash." "Yes, ma'am," he said stiffly. "Come, get in the car. Alaskan air can still cut through." They clambered in, the doors folded down around them, and the car drove off, evidently knowing its destination. The air temperature inside quickly climbed. Mel tentatively slipped off her gloves. "Yes, the cold." Yamanaka sat facing away from the direction of motion, looking back at the two of them. "And I do admit my aging bones miss the warmth." "You're from Hawaii," she said.
"That's right."
"Which has its own problems, even after more than a month since the blink. Did you know that with the anomalous tides, there have been beachings of dolphins, even whales?" Leaving the airport compound, the car slid smoothly along a broad avenue lined with stocky, modern buildings, some smartwood, some not. There was little traffic on the road, no pedestrians to be seen on the wide sidewalks. Then, abruptly, the car dipped a little, swaying to the right before recovering. Mel grabbed a handhold. Yamanaka smiled at her. "Don't be alarmed. The ground here is notoriously uneven. You'll get used to it." "Permafrost," she said.
"Correct," said Yamanaka, "or the lack of it. Lenses of ancient ice underground. When they melt, the water soaks away or evaporates, and the ground just subsides. It's been a global warming phenomenon since the last century. Since long before the big migrant relocation programs kicked in, 15 years ago or more. Certainly before the US federal government moved up here after the DC floods." She laughed, genial. "Maybe not enough attention was given to fixing the holes before the president moved in." Mel, not a particularly social animal herself, and with Xi taciturn beside her, admired the way this very senior figure, the president's science advisor, was effortlessly putting them at their ease. "But the winter White House facilities themselves are impressive. I shouldn't promise anything, but if your pitch is good enough, you might get a tour." Xi looked faintly concerned, Mel thought. She said, "If the pitch is good enough." Now Yamanaka frowned. "You can understand we have been in a rolling crisis here since Blink Day, as all governments have been. A situation, I suspect, which will go on for years, decades, and between us, I'm not sure even President Cox understands this yet. I have to tell you that whatever the merits of your proposal, when you and Serena make it, there simply may not be the resources to follow it through." Now she looked angry. Before he could speak, Mel took his hand in hers. "My advice is to just stay calm," Yamanaka said, observing them. "Everybody expects you to be nervous, and everybody knows you have a burden of grief to carry. You'll likely get some hard questioning, but we're here to listen, believe it or not." Mel thought that Yamanaka would not be so complacent if she knew all she had to tell her today. The car pulled smoothly off the road and approached a white-painted wall, maybe 3 meters tall, with a barred gate. National Guard in black uniforms and visors patrolled, and drones buzzed overhead. Beyond the gate, at the end of a short drive, the winter White House was a blunt box, ultra-modern and indeed white. Mel longed to dig out her own phone, to send pictures of all this back to Jane, at school in England. She knew it would never be allowed. The gate opened with what seemed like reluctance. As they got out of the car, the building's main door, wood-faced, but with a visible metal substructure, swung open for them. Yamanaka led the way forward. "Come through. You should be cleared, but there are the usual retinal face ident checks. Also, put your hand on the pad as you pass. You know the drill. Oh, and the voice check. Repeat after me. Mary had a little lamb." Once through the security barrier, Yamanaka strode down a brightly lit, sparsely decorated corridor. Most of the offices are subterranean, actually. "Here we are, my own office, Pro Tem." A side door opened for her as she approached, and she ducked inside. Mel and she followed. The room, brightly lit by ceiling panels, was another box in the plain white that seemed to be the only colour scheme in here. A desk with one big padded chair behind it, a couple of office chairs before it. More chairs stacked in one corner. "Let me get this place set up." Yamanaka tapped the walls in a couple of places, and hatches opened to reveal a coffee maker, already steaming, and Mel wondered if this room had known Yamanaka was coming from the moment her car headed this way. Yamanaka briskly shrugged off her heavy coat, threw it on the chair stack. Her outfit beneath was a billowing trouser suit, brilliantly coloured, flamboyant in this pallid place, Mel thought, and Hawaiian, no doubt. "Please, be comfortable. Well, as you can be. Hang your coats on the back of the door. Sit down." She gestured at the chairs before the table. "I'll fetch coffee, if you both..." Mel and she complied. Mel a little uncomfortably. Yamanaka's vigorous, big-scale hospitality now felt a little intimidating. Mel was suddenly aware of how junior they were, to be bearing the news they had to impart. Yamanaka dumped three coffees on the desktop. "Please sit. The coffee is not bad, printed or not." She sat. Mel sipped the not-bad coffee. She stacked his phones on the desk and looked around. "The place seems... sterile." Yamanaka raised her eyebrows at his frankness and smiled. "I guess so. Look, this is a new facility, newer even than most of New Anchorage. And in the build, they prioritize utility and security over comfort, let alone aesthetics. But right now, post-blink, this is one of the few US government facilities where you'll actually find senior government players like, well, like me. And I'm about the most junior of that pantheon. You see the response across the nation, of course, the National Guard at their stations, martial law in some places, civic leaders, and the hospitals geared up for mass casualties from, well, whatever comes next. We all grew up amid calamities, didn't we? We're used to it. As for the federal government, since Blink Day, we've been operating a COG protocol, continuation of government. So senior officials, from the president and vice president downwards, are scattered across US territory in the bunkers, such as here, NORAD in Colorado. Some of these facilities are many decades old, but still serviceable if you really need to be safe. The president herself is in Raven Rock, under Pennsylvania. I've been there, actually. Baby boomer chic. I guess you won't know what that means. Most of the congressional leaders are at the Mount Weather Emergency Operations Center in Virginia. In the mole hole, they call that one. The Strategic Command underground bunker from where they once planned to fight nuclear wars. In a crisis, the president usually has most of her senior advisors close by, such as, well, me, her science advisor, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, her national security advisor, the Secretary of State, the directors of the CIA and FBI, the White House counsel, oh, and her political advisors. I think President Cox is leaning on us all a little just now because she's feeling out of her depth, she said abruptly, surprising Mel. Yamanaka sipped coffee, raised her eyebrows. Well, that's obvious enough. She was only elected in November, of course. One of her first actions post-blink had to be to postpone her own inauguration. Yes. She's bewildered. Yamanaka hesitated, studying them. You need to understand where the president's head is right now. Look, if you'll forgive me, you're both pretty young, and the young often have a different perspective to us older folk. Before you make your pitch to me, let me give you a little context. When I grew up, climate change was hitting the country hard. The interior was desiccated, especially once the aquifer and glacier water supplies dried up. Colorado, California too. Elsewhere, flooding, massive incursions of the ocean in the southeast, over Florida, Louisiana, Georgia, the Carolinas. No surprise that those states led the secession. And of course, the major flooding events along the East Coast. But you know what? We adapted and survived. We, working with the Canadians and the Mexicans, I should say, who took a lot of our immigrants. We put in place massive technological fixes where we could. And of course, we moved people. Whole new cities sprouting like mushrooms in the Appalachians, in the Canadian North. But we got through it all, by God. You grew up with this. We, my generation, had to deal with it. And I think, in the end, over the course of my life, I can feel proud of my country. Hell, even of most of my presidents. Proud of what we did. But now President Cox is going to have to live up to that standard, even exceed it. Because of the blink, she said. Because of the blink. You know, we have a whole set of national response scenarios. Guidance on how to deal with various calamities, natural or human, as dreamed up and war-gamed over decades. Of course, along comes the blink, which is like nothing anybody ever foresaw. The Earth is in a different orbit now, damn it. Everyone knows we weren't prepared. How could we be? And then this is an unusual crisis, psychologically. The sheer abstract nature of it doesn't help. Lights in the sky. You have a high anxiety level anyhow among a public that has grown up against a background of disasters. Do you know about Freud's analysis of fear? He said, you can have a kind of rational fear of something specific, but then there is a free-floating fear which is always there and just attaches itself to any candidate it can find. A neurotic fear. Freud called it dread. I think that's exactly what many of us are feeling now, in the face of this huge, abstract threat, Galaxius. Dread. And so anyhow, now there is the usual panic buying, the survivalist retreats to their bunkers, the Mormons flee to Utah where Jesus will return to Earth. She looked at Mel, a little uncomfortably. The religious hypothesis is a strong one in this country. The idea that this is some kind of punishment from God, or a God, despite all the specific scientific evidence. Those doubters overlap with other groups who think it has all been some kind of hoax. She nodded, puny Yahweh. Mel remembered Charlie Marlowe's facetious conversation on Blink Day itself. She'd used those words then, and she'd repeated the phrase in many conversations and broadcasts since. But Yamanaka said now, it would help us all greatly if the Astronomer Royal did not utter those words publicly again. Not on my watch, anyhow. Nothing good ever came from provocation. I leave that with you. And in the meantime, she went on, our government has to keep everybody fed and safe. Anyhow, that's what our mint new president is having to deal with, even as she learns the way to the White House lavatory. She nodded. I'm Chinese, and we have a word. We are a culture that dreads the return of Luan, of the chaos of a disorderly past. Yamanaka smiled. Maybe we Americans need that as a lone word. Mel thought all this over. We need to understand how the president is thinking, even as she's coming to terms with the job. That's why you're telling us this. Yes. But on the other hand, I'm on your side, I think. My impression is that it's some kind of positive proposal, yes? You mean to do something? If so, if it's of any value at all, I want your pitch to get through. She said this with a vehemence that surprised Mel. And that's why I'm speaking to you. Look, I'm basically an exobiologist. I'm no psychologist, let alone a politician. We have to deal with the disasters to come. She has to, President Cox. But I think, right now, She needs something that is positive, not just anti-negative. Something we can do and build that will not only do us some good, but maybe make us feel better about ourselves, and thus help us wage the wider war to come. "You're right," she said calmly. "I understand. America does stuff. And I hope you will welcome Serena's proposal, which, yes, is a positive act. But," he glanced at Mel, she nodded back, "now's the time." "We have something else to tell you," she said. Mel put in, "something sensitive, diplomatically speaking, we think." She blurted, "It's because of something America did that Galaxius is here now. This is my own hypothesis. That's what I believe." Nyamanaka just stared, frowning. Mel glanced from one to the other. "So much for the diplomacy, Mel," she said. "Professor Yamanaka, you've been sent the briefings Charlie Marlowe prepared for the British government, the latest data, on the blink, and its causes, as much as we have figured out." Yamanaka showed a flash of impatience. "Summarise for me." Mel spoke carefully, but she had worked alongside Charlie Marlowe for years, which had toughened her up for this kind of presentation. "To begin with, we believe that Galaxius, the name given to this phenomenon, is a conscious agent with Kardashev Type 3 energy resources." "The Kardashev types? I know, go on." She summarised Marlowe's argument about the displacement of the sun and what it implied of Galaxius's restriction to light speed. And she spoke of the revealed planetary systems, Barnard's, Altair, 55 Cancri, and the discoveries in the moon, the ice packet fired from the Lurker. "I have been briefed about the Lurker. At least I have been now. I've never heard of that installation on the moon before the blink. Plausible deniability, they told me in the end. I had heard rumours of the revealed planetary systems, which does make me wonder what else I don't know, or haven't been told. We are grateful for the sharing, of course. Go on, please. What has America got to do with it?" "Well, the light speed limit puts boundaries on Galaxius's ability to respond to events. Actually, it was she here who figured that out, and who made predictions, made us look for evidence we never expected to find. The changed planetary systems. Never imagined." She nodded to Shi. He said evenly, "It was Galaxius's evident lightspeed limit that made me think of this." "That, and the fact that the ice mass probe was fired off at close to lightspeed itself. I wondered where it was going, and how long it might take to get there, and if it did carry a message, how soon we might expect some kind of reply." Yamanaka nodded. "Go on." "Right. The Lurker shot seems to be aimed at Barnard's star, the nearest of these camouflaged systems, and the furthest we've spotted in this set of changed systems is 41 light-years away, 55 Cancri. But just suppose this isn't the first signal the Lurker has sent from the solar system to 55C. Possibly via Barnard's, Altair, possibly direct. The question is, why should any such signal have been sent at all? Because of something we did. That's what I believe, and others." Mel wondered which others. Not herself, Tash, Marlowe. She was evidently engaged in conversations on another level, with some shadowy cabal of truth searchers. He said now, "I believe that the monitor on the moon, whatever it is, may have been watching us. Well, possibly since before we were human at all, let alone spacefarers. And now it has observed us doing something Galaxius wouldn't like." Yamanaka frowned. "And what exactly?" She nodded, comparatively calmly, Mel thought. "That's where the timing comes in. Let me work through the logic, and you'll see for yourself. The lunar probe sees this action of ours and sends a report to its neighbouring, stations. You would think the more distant the target, the more significant that target must be as a node in some communications network. And the data gets to 55C. After 41 years, okay? And if a response was sent back, it would have reached the moon at least 41 more years after that. Maybe a response was sent immediately. Maybe there was some preparation. I think there was as much as a year's delay at one end or another. Maybe because Galaxius wanted to time its response to coincide with our solar eclipse. Sorry, I'm running ahead. My head is too full of this stuff. I believe a response to that first report was received from 55C no later than 2056. And as we know, the blink has occurred in 2057. But you're trying to convince me that this chain of responses was set in motion because of something we must have done. My mental arithmetic is awful. 2056 or 57 minus twice 41 years. The signal to 55C must have been sent maybe around 1973, 1974. Why that date? She took a breath. Because, I believe, at that time we humans did something that we had never done before. Something extraordinary. On the 3rd of December 1973, an American spacecraft called Pioneer 10 passed Jupiter. In fact, on that day, it reached the periapsis. Closest approach to the planet, Mel put in. Yamanaka, the exobiologist, nodded a subtle thanks. Yes, she said. Only about 120,000 kilometres above the cloud tops. And there was a gravitational slingshot. As the mission designers had planned, Pioneer reached escape velocity, solar escape velocity. Yamanaka got the point all at once, very visibly, Mel thought. Her jaw dropped. She sat back. She thumped her smart tabletop with her fist. My God! At that moment, Pioneer 10 became the first human-made object to escape the solar system, in principle, right? It had the energy. It had the velocity. And all it had to do was to coast on out, beyond the orbits of Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Energetically speaking, it had already escaped from the sun's gravity well at that moment in 1973. Exactly. Pioneer is long inert by now, she said, but still sailing out of the system, never to return. A sister ship followed it, Pioneer 2, and then the Voyagers, and then... I know. Yamanaka waved that away. But your point is, Pioneer 10 was the first of our ships to get away, right? To break out, and something on the moon was watching. Yes. And so the lurker at Medii sent a report to 55C. Maybe to Barnard's, Altair too. But I bet 55C is the key node, a light speed interval later. The response comes back. It comes now. Yamanaka scribbled numbers on a pad. Or at least, with this gap for the timing, the solar eclipse coincidence, and then the blink. My God! She sat up straighter. It all fits. I need to check this over, but I think you sold me. We'd been sending out radio signals for decades, and nobody cared about that, evidently. But as soon as we start sending physical objects out of the system, wham, the door is slammed in our faces. She shook her head in bewilderment. And hell, this is so sensitive, diplomatically, politically. So we have a covert US probe babysitting this ET thing on the moon for decades. And then we have the Pioneer, another US probe, triggering this huge existential response. As if it's all our fault. Mel nodded. You'd like to think no rational person would apportion blame. Yamanaka eyed her. There are probably no rational persons even in this room. Welcome to the world of politics. The US will be accused of cover-ups, of hubris, of further cover-ups yet. Well, we did cover up the discovery of the lurker. That's why we brought this to you first, Professor Yamanaka, Mel said. Maybe we can help. She explained Fred Bowles' strategy. Fred had foreseen this kind of response. So by sending Mel and she to this briefing, he was trying to smuggle in as much as he could discreetly, so that Yamanaka could take it to her government in the best way she saw fit. Okay, Yamanaka said, evidently thinking fast. So we can figure out a defense about this Pioneer thing before the shitstorm. Good, thank you. Smart move by Fred, and thoughtful. Well, okay, with preparation time, we'll handle it. But beyond that, we know a bit more about Galaxius now, don't we? She frowned. Why, there's even a subtext of contempt. The casual revelation of those exoplanets. Think about it. For us to be allowed to see the reality of those systems now after more light-speed delays. The masking must have been dropped at 55C as soon as the moon signal reached there. And presumably, the other nodes dropped their masks as an instruction through some kind of command chain that was sent back out. Yes, I'd call that contempt. She looked at Shi sharply. So Shi, you really figured this out yourself? She actually blushed. Well, I was surrounded by the right people who had access to the right data. Bullshit with respect, Mel said. Yamaneka said, agreed. You deserve a hell of a lot of credit, if you're right. So, what have we learned? That we have been watched for decades by this lurker? At least decades, possibly for much longer. We dare to send one flimsy probe out of our own system, and the response is a report sent up through some kind of communication chain. After which, the blink. She nodded. What can that be seen as but a warning? We are being contained. She smiled, grim. Which I fear is unacceptable. Anyhow, Shi, here you are with some cunning plan, it seems. What do you and Serena Jones have to offer us in response to Galaxius? He smiled back. A spaceship, he said softly. The ship that will allow a human crew to follow where Pioneer 10 went. Whether Galaxius likes it or not. Mel herself hadn't heard of this. It was a surprise, startling even. Yamanaka stared at Shi. Then she grinned hugely. Hell yes! Wu Shi, I'll get you and Serena Jones in front of President Cox. Count on it.